From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us, as always. I'm Megan Mack, flying solo today. If you're new to Weekend Connections, welcome, thank you. This is a weekly review of some of the standout moments from Connections with Evan Dawson during the week, and you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts every Friday afternoon. We'll start this week's episode with a conversation about media coverage, particularly media coverage of the events following the annual Puerto Rican Festival. Those events, which often include disorderly behavior or sometimes dangerous incidents, are not part of the festival, and they happen miles from the festival grounds. Despite that, those events often lead media coverage of the festival itself. Leaders in the local Puerto Rican community have been frustrated by this for years, and in October, they formed a grassroots group to try to resolve the issue. The Northeast Safety Committee issued a survey to gauge perceptions of those post-festival incidents and try to learn what community members want in the way of a celebration following the festival. They learned that the majority of respondents do want some kind of organized celebration, something like a caravana, and the committee hopes to work with other organizations to make that happen in the future. In this clip, members of the committee discuss why they think those post-festival events have overshadowed the festival itself and what they hope to see in the future. You'll hear Anthony Plonzinski, Annette Ramos, but up first, here's Anthony Nunez.
We do live in a microwave society where everything is a kind of a gotcha moment. Everything is here you go. How can we catch that person's eye who's scrolling through Facebook or changing the channel and see if we can hold them for longer than 30 seconds of attention? And we do that with these shock value pictures and videos that's going on. That is not necessarily fair and holds a lot of bias in many times. I think that what we're trying to do is we understand that everything is not perfect in society and what we can do to make that better. Maybe one day will maybe translate to something else and maybe something bigger in the larger scale of things. I give everybody who's involved in this a lot of credit because they are, I think you said earlier on in your show, everybody wears multiple hats. So we're doing this, we have our full-time careers and everything else, and we're still trying to make this one sliver of hope and difference for this time.
It's also important to know that this is a very complicated issue, and that's why this has been the third rail of festivals when it comes to what's happening in the community. Nobody wants, in a sense before now, nobody really wanted to touch it. We only had reactionary responses. I think this is probably the only proactive response other than a proactive police response, which is not the only or the right response. It has to be a community collective. And we saw that in the survey results. I mean, when you look at those who go to the Northeast and those who attend the Puerto Rican Festival, they're not the same people. And they literally said that. They're like, we do not go to the festival. We hang out in the Northeast of Rochester. So we're talking about two segments here, which really makes that a community issue. It's not a festival issue. It's not a Puerto Rican issue. There's something of a need there that they're bridging off of and building off of, much like the St. Patrick's Day Parade is built off of. The bars are built off of that. And the Park Ave Fest, the house parties are built off of that. Those house parties are not sanctioned events for the Park Ave Festival, but they are probably what people talk about the most.
And the most arrests happen during that cluster of time in the evenings. And with that, we wanted to speak not to that community, we wanted to speak for that community. And that's why it was so essential for us to do that survey and garner those pieces. And then also we realized you can't do a hierarchical approach to solving a problem. You have to get out and pound the pavement, which Anthony did, by the way, in the early stages. And Rosemary and I will be disseminating these posters in the next couple of days. So the point is that it's got to be the communities. And one of our posters really speaks to, it's our community. It's our neighborhood. Why would we want to mess up our own neighborhood? And then the other piece was car safety. We realized that a lot of the arrests weren't violent arrests. They were, you know, suspended licenses, unauthorized use of a vehicle. So those were things that we knew we as grassroots leaders could speak to. And the posters and the video and the campaigns and the PSAs and the media tour really says, help us spread this positive message. Help us change the imaging and perception of the Latinx community in Rochester.
Next, the Parent Leadership Training Institute's Rochester chapter began in 2012. And since then, dozens of parents have gained skills and civics knowledge to become change agents in Rochester. Some have received grants for community projects, others have changed school policies, and some have even run for office. We invited PLTI graduates to join us on the show to discuss their success stories. It comes at a time where parental involvement in schools and communities is on the rise. In this clip, you'll hear Erin Taylor, who used the skills she developed in the PLTI program to address bullying in her son's school.
My children have, they've been in the city school district for many years, mm-hmm. and bullying was always an issue. It kind of progressed and just got worse as the years went by. And as my children got older, especially with my youngest son and him dealing with some weight issues and that sort of thing, and that was a really big trigger for him. So I say a few years ago, my son was at a different school, and I worked very closely with the parent liaison. And so I think it softened some of the blow there. She was a dynamic leader in the school. And so we were able to really collaborate. She helped me with resources and just other ways to get around the system to provide the safety and all that I needed for my son. But she ended up leaving the school, and I didn't have that resource in the school building. And so the issues just, it came to a point where I had to go to the district and have my son removed from the school. And then he moved to what was considered the best school within the city, and there were issues in that school as well. And so
can I just before yes. you jump ahead here, as a parent, mm-hmm. how did it hit you? I mean, I've had only one time I've gotten a phone call about, you know, an incident with my son and being on the receiving end of a little bit of bullying, and it right. was an incident that, you know, we were able to get past in one day. But it still took my breath away, you know, just the way, we ache for our kids.
Yes.
And for you to kind of go to a school thinking, okay, change scenery, and then to encounter that again.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
It was heartbreaking, to tell you the truth, because it was really bad. It was a physical assault from a student he had no dealings with. It was a brand new school. I think it was within the first week of him attending the school, attending that new school. And it just never got better. And then, honestly, I found out some months later that the reports were not going to the parent liaison in the new school. She had no knowledge of the incidents happening. She had, because apparently in that school they have, when there's issues of bullying, it's supposed to be reported to the parent liaison. Mm-hmm. It never happened. And I received a lot of pushback. And because of that, and just having this training of PLTI, and just being immersed in that weekly, it was just like, oh no, I have to do something, and I can do something. And I just figured out how to maneuver within the district and within the school. I realized that I can't expect everyone to help, and I probably shouldn't expect everyone to help, mm-hmm. but there is someone who cares. And I realized that, you know, and I found people within the actual district and people within his school who were willing to back me.
Who were your biggest allies?
I have to say the parent liaison, and her name escapes me right now, but the parent liaison at my son's school, his counselor, and I went to parent engagement. And so the folks in parent engagement really, really helped as well. It was everyone in that office helped. Whenever I had an issue, I could call, and things were rectified within a day.
And what has changed the most since you started advocating?
For my son, he's currently being homeschooled. For that year, things definitely turned around. And I had those resources and I had that network, but it's for him, it was overwhelming. And so I pulled him and just decided to homeschool him. And that's what we do right now. We've played with the idea of him returning to the district, but he's not ready.
Okay. For that. And have you learned enough, both in your experience, but also through PLTI, that if he goes back to the district, you're going to be able to advocate in more effective ways, you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are things that I, just some standards and some requirements and things that I have in place prior to him even touching the grounds. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And what do you think the message really is for all schools that are dealing with bullying? What do you want to see change?
I think they need to take the complaints seriously. It affects children's emotional well-being. When a child is in a situation where they don't feel safe, it can affect their performance. And not only that, it doesn't just affect the children, it affects staff members as well. I have very close relationships with many teachers and staff and from administration down. And there are people who have disclosed many personal things with me. And there are teachers who are afraid, quite frankly. So, mm-hmm. you know, I would really hope that they take it a little bit more seriously than they do and really report it.
We'll end the week with a conversation about art. And you might be surprised that a urinal was a big part of this conversation. You'll see what I mean in a moment. The discussion was actually about whether food can be art, and it was part of our Summer of Food series. I'll let the guests explain the rest. It'll make more sense then. In this clip, you'll hear Lorna Underwood from the Caribbean Heritage Restaurant, Kimberly Roth from Bamboo Panda Catering, and up first are Drew Shappett and Sean Wolf from Farmers Creekside Tavern and Inn in Leroy. Here's Drew.
Like food, it depends on a very specific set of circumstances. And I think we have to take a look at how we define art, first of all, before we can kind of get into the knit and grit of that.
I think that's very fair. So go ahead, take a stab at it. How are you defining it in this context then?
So this is actually a conversation Sean and I have had on numerous occasions. And it's sort of an ongoing conversation. And it's kind of too big a question just to pigeonhole it into one generic definition. That being said, how I personally look at it is sort of the intentional transmission or expression of culture or imagination, or sort of the way we experience the world in a form that evokes either emotional response or challenges our perceptions of the world.
Okay. Sean, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'm kind of the opinion that of the Duchamp camp, where art is whatever the artist says it is. You know, I mean, he went to an exhibition and hung a urinal on a wall and said, "Behold."
Come on, man.
Yeah, well, you go to MoMA and there's painted 2x4s on the wall or strings held together.
Okay, see, but we're going to fight over this. We're going to fight, Sean Wolf. Here's why. I am somebody, I'm going to out myself. When I go to, I was in Bilbao in Spain with the WXXI Travel Club and the Guggenheim. There was a canvas on the floor, huge canvas, and the artist had been sort of hanging over off a platform, dumping blue paint from about 40 meters down onto the canvas. And that was it. Just blue paint from 40 meters. That was the art. And the artist's explanation was, well, I don't think the artist should directly engage with the canvas. And I said, interesting. Next time I host a show, I'm going to say the intro. And then I'm going to say, guests, talk amongst yourself, because I don't think the host ought to directly talk to anybody they're interviewing. So I'll see you in an hour. Have a great time. I didn't get it. Even though they said most of the stuff in the Guggenheim was art, I didn't get it. I didn't see it as art.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of take the counterpoint on this.
See, I like it. We're fighting already. This is good.
So Sean brought up the Duchamp hanging a urinal on the wall, and he says it's art. But can something be art if the consumers don't view it that way? For instance, if I walked into that building and I saw a urinal hanging on the wall, if I didn't know it was intentional, would I just think, hey, these guys have no idea how to install a bathroom?
But I think it's perspective as well. I think it's everybody has a different perspective on what art is. So I think that's what you're saying. You're saying this is not art.
Well, I think it's more just I maybe don't want to go as far to say as what I saw at the Guggenheim wasn't art. It's that I didn't find any connection to it.
Okay.
And I thought that the creation was so vague as to be uninspiring. Mm-hmm. That's where I was. Whereas I'd have no problem finding connection to the food that you make.
I'm not pandering. I mean, I say that honestly. Mm-hmm. If you want to tell me that there's something artistic about this creation, I can't argue with it, because there's so many elements of intentionality that you're creating, not just, as Sean points out, and the chefs I quoted pointed out, all the different senses that we're working on. Mm-hmm. I actually think that's much more artistic than what I saw in the Guggenheim. If I went to Caribbean Heritage or any of, but do you think that's wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Okay, well, but Sean, push back now. Let's fight a little, because if you were at the Guggenheim with me and I went, I don't get that, man. Come on.
Well, that didn't speak to you.
Right.
And just like the things that we do.
I don't think it spoke to the artist. That's what I'm saying. I think the artist was just like, let's just dump paint from 40 meters
let's
and then
try this
cash
and
a check, man.
And he's in the Guggenheim. So somebody on a board of directors or whatever said, yes, this speaks to me.
Yes.
Somebody is writing an email to me right now saying, Evan, you have so disappointed me today. I've listened for years, and I didn't know you were such a Philistine. And it turns out I am. But listeners, please try to sway me on the modern art stuff, because I'm trying. I'm trying. Oh, I don't know. Where are you on that, Kimberly?
I mean, honestly, just listening to you guys, I think art is a progression of life. I think it started off in a certain way with the ancient statues of Greece, and I'm relating this to food. Food used to be simple and elegant, but now throughout time it's evolved to be, you know, tweely and colorful and this and that, much like art. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not really into art. I just like making food look pretty so people pay me. I mean, much like that artist probably just wanted to cause a stir. Maybe he knew it was, you know, not going to be considered art. Maybe he wanted to make you think like that. Maybe he's trying to stir up controversy. I don't know.
Well, and to be fair here,
make you think about it.
And to be fair, what makes me think is not going to be the same as what makes Lorna or Sean or Drew or anybody think. Yeah. And I take that point, which is why I do, as much as I've been a little cheeky about the Guggenheim, there was one piece there that was all a big black canvas and with tiny little blip of light, maybe 1/1000th of the canvas in the bottom corner. And the name of the piece was something like One Voice. It was about the notion of political darkness and how sometimes one voice from the proletariat can actually spark change and light, but it has to come from the ground up. And I thought, okay, that speaks to me. Whereas
Absolutely.
A lot of people walk by Absolutely. It and went, I got nothing. I got mm-hmm. nothing. That mm-hmm. one was like, yes, I'm there. Whereas sometimes just a dot, I don't get. Tom writes to us and says, Evan, art, this is a quote from Marshall McLuhan, art is anything you can get away with. Well, that's a little cynical, like a urinal on a wall. Go ahead, Sean.
I think that buys into the same, you know, art is whatever the artist says it is. And I mean, I think sometimes art is intentionally provocative. I mean, you talk about a guy dumping paint from 45 meters above. I mean, we're here talking about it however many years after he made it.
That's good.
You should dump your next burger
That's
from
good.
40
Gravy.
Meters and see how that goes, man.
That's already in the works.
Thank you, Drew.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Evan Dawson's somewhere out enjoying the weekend. On behalf of both of us, thanks so much. We'll talk to you Monday.